this meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee to order. I'm Representative Dave Pinto, the chair of the committee, and welcome the members of the public. A reminder that this meeting is being held pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows for remote meetings of this type. Reminder to everyone on the Zoom to stay muted when you're not speaking. And materials for this meeting have been posted to our committee's website, so members of the public can find them there, and have also been sent to folks who are on the Zoom call with us. So we'll start with taking of the roll, and if Ms. Chambers can please do that.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Juergens.
Present.
Representative Cotiza-Watoon. Representative Morrison.
Present.
Present.
Was that Representative Cotiza-Watoon? Representative Wozlawick?
Present.
Representative Wolgamott?
Present.
If we can have Ms. Chambers, if you can call in Representative Franson again. I believe that she's now connected to audio.
Representative Franson?
We're going to get her unmuted here.
Representative Franson?
Present.
There we go.
For the third time.
And
Representative Cotiza-Watoon?
I think that she's logging in, so we'll have her connect once she logs in. But quorum is present, and so thank you. Members, we had a presentation on Tuesday at the end of our hearing on home visiting from Ms. Reckinger from the Department of Health. And so what I want to do is start by just finishing that up. We'll spend just a bit of time hearing the completion of that and asking questions as things were truncated on Tuesday. And then the bulk of the hearing today is going to be on a critical topic in our work and really the work of everything that we're doing in the legislature, which is adverse childhood experiences. So we're going to be hearing from presenter on that. And I do believe that Representative Cotiza-Watoon is with us now. Representative Cotiza-Watoon, if you can just note your appearance.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Sorry about the delay.
Good morning. No problem. I'm going to have Ms. Reckinger identify herself again for the record. And if you can complete your presentation, you may just sort of remind us where we were on Tuesday, and then we'll have questions.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm Dawn Reckinger. I'm the manager of family home visiting at the Minnesota Department of Health. And we were on about, I'm going to share my screen in a second, slide 10 or 11 of about 22 slides, so about halfway through. So I'm going to start at that point. And I'm going to share my screen. Okay, and I'm going to move you guys over so I can see you. Okay, so I assume, Mr. Chair, you can see my screen? All right.
I can see the screen, yep.
Good, thank you. All right, so I'm pretty sure we had just gone over this one, and just to kind of remind everyone, one of the points I had made is so, this is our one color map, and what it means is that an evidence-based home visiting program, and remember, evidence-based means that we know the science behind it, we know that what it does works. It's kind of the same of when you go into the doctor and you think you have a strep throat, and they're like, here, take this, do this, this will get rid of your strep throat. It's a similar concept of that we know what to do. These, if you're purple, it means it's available. However, what it doesn't mean is that all the kids in that county could get that service. In fact, we know that really the range of services, and I don't think I said this last week, is anywhere from 3% of kids in a given county are receiving evidence-based home visiting services to, I think the highest we go is just a little under 40%. That's an anomaly to be that high. Most of our counties have 20% or less of eligible families and children are receiving home visiting services. And it's a capacity issue. So we don't have enough funding and reimbursement for agencies and counties and tribes to have enough home visitors to serve all those families. So they serve the highest needs is usually how we do it. So I think
Ms. Reckinger, can you just, for members of the public who may not have been with us on Tuesday, could you very quickly sort of a one sentence definition of home visiting again, just to remind folks?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Home visiting is basically a voluntary service where a trained home visitor goes into a home or meets the family where they're most comfortable meeting. So it could be home, could be grandma's house, could be a park as needed. And they provide support so that the parents can raise their child in a safe, nurturing, and healthy environment, and that the parents can reach the goals they have for themselves and also the goals they have for their child. Again, it's completely voluntary, and we talk about long-term, and usually long-term is ideally starting prenatally or as close to birth as they can and going till the child is about 2 to 3 years old.
Okay, thank you. And sure. Please continue.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm gonna go to the next. Okay. So we're going to quickly just do a little view of the children served. And if you're a person who looks closely at numbers, you'll see that the number of families, caregivers, it's really caregivers served is going to be a little different than children. And so it's a little lower number. I think the caregiver was just a little under 12,000 and the children served is more around on 10,000 at the top, 674. And that's because in many families, we're having multiple caregivers participate. Often I would say in probably 90 to 95% of families, the mom or pregnant woman is participating. We try to get the dad or the partner to participate. Sometimes it's grandma participating or another adult that's gonna play a large role in that child's life. So that's why the numbers are a little bit different. So this just sort of goes, we did just some basic demographics. In an ideal world, if we were serving all children, you know, roughly 0 to 2 to 3 years old, we'd have them sort of split up a third, a third, a third. So, you know, a third of the kids, families would be starting off and brand new and be less than 1 year old. A third would be sort of in the middle range, you know, somewhere between, you know, not quite 1 to 2, and then we'd have ones that were getting ready to graduate out of the program. The reason it's higher on this end is a couple of reasons. So you can see that we have almost 80% of our kids are in the less than 2 years old and not quite spread out as much. Is one, we had an influx of money in 2017, so a lot of programs are starting up. So all those families they were recruiting are pregnant women and people with brand new babies, so it's higher, it's gonna be higher on that end. And the other reason is that as families do better, and also these are highly mobile, and sometimes we know pretty families facing a lot of risk factors, there is, even though we intend and hope that they'll stay in for 2 to 3 years, families move and have different needs, and so they drop out. And again, this is voluntary. This is based on what the family needs, so that's why those are off. On our most recent data, we know that about 38% of the children are living at or below the federal poverty level, and I think one of our MA people went over that, so you know, those are pretty low numbers. And then there's just a distribution of the child's race. And I don't have enough staff to do some cool charts on looking at trends, but just from looking at when I was updating this slide, I would say that the number of children of color, Black and African and our American Indian were increasing from the previous slides that I had done about 2 years ago. And I would imagine that is a trend that we're seeing overall.
And Ms. Regenter, I should probably note, we've probably got about 5 minutes for the rest of your presentation.
Faster.
Yeah. So,
okay.
Yeah,
sorry.
Thank you.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. So we also do evaluation and quality improvement. This is where we provide support at the state. We look at areas of growth and development, well-being and positive parenting, and referrals. These are some of the key benchmarks that we look at and also that the feds look at for the federal money we receive. We look at child health, child development, and school readiness, economic self-sufficiency. Are they getting linkages and referrals outside? It's, the home visitor doesn't do everything. The idea is to get in with the family and refer them out to what the community offers. Looking at maternal health, certainly maternal depression, parenting skills, reductions in child maltreatment, and reductions in juvenile delinquency, family violence, and crime. And we have benchmarks, a lot of process benchmarks that we look at for the evaluation for this. And we kind of cover three areas of training. We do training, so you don't just start a home visiting model. And even once you do, it takes a lot of support to get it up and running. We do evaluation, and we also work with, they're called the model developers, who create these models to make sure that agencies are, you know, doing what they need to do, getting everything in place, getting the supports in place. Again, it's a very capacity building, very supportive environment where we don't approach this at all from a regulatory place. And we're constantly working with our grantees to figure out how they can provide services better, how we can help them reorganize better, how they can get their outreach better. So that's really how we work. And then I'll just quick go over the funding for home visiting. And I included, home visiting has a lot of different funding sources. And a huge part, especially now after 2017, is MDH grant funding. So we have about $36 million between the federal grant funding that we have and the state funding that we have that we give out. Individual grantees could get grants from foundations. If you're a nurse, which is the kind of bottom part of the slide, if you're an agency that employs nurses, you can apply for third-party reimbursement. And of course, many counties put their local levies towards it. So just quickly on the billing, again, if you're a public health nurse or an RN, like a two-year degree and supervised by a nurse, you can bill for home visiting services. And in 2017, the legislature passed an MA rate of 140 if you're a nurse and if you're doing an evidence-based home visiting. We know anecdotally, because we're not allowed to collect data on this, that the rates range from $25 to about $140 otherwise. So if you're a public health nurse, but you're not doing evidence-based home visiting, you might get $25, you might get $140. It really varies around the state.
And Ms. Reckinger, can you clarify, is that per visit or per, what is that dollar, is that number?
Good question. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It is per visit. So, and the visits have to be 31 minutes long. So if you just were in for a 5-minute visit, you wouldn't be able to bill for this. And then there's definitions of who's a provider, and that's pretty much the definition there. And then the definition is, you know, what did they provide in that home visiting? So it's $140 or $25 per visit. And the same thing for community health workers. I'm a little less familiar with that because up until about 2 years ago, we didn't have any community health workers doing home visiting. Their rate is $16, and I believe it's per visit. I'd actually have to check into that, but I believe it's per visit. And that's, again, just regulations of different providers. They're not under the same part of the CMS plan, so it's all in different areas. If you're like, why are they so different? I'm going to go to the next one. So, again, we oversee $36 million in federal and state funding. There's $8.5 million in TANF funding, which the legislature allocates every year. So it's part of the pull down that DHS gets from the feds. And since 2003, the legislature has said, you know, we want this amount of money to go to home visiting because we think it helps further those goals. We get about $9 million in MCVI funding. It's pretty stable at this point. In 2015, the legislature awarded $2 million specifically to the Nurse Family Partnership Program, which is a very specific model. So we put out money for that. And then, of course, there was the new state funding for evidence-based home visiting, and that opened it up to tribes, counties, and nonprofits. So we took on nonprofits in 2017. If you look at a bigger picture, 75% of this funding must go to towards evidence-based home visiting programs.
Okay. And this, can you just go back to that? That's, so a couple of things. We've got a couple of members who have hands up with questions. I just okay. want to clarify on this slide that your reference just now to evidence-based home visiting programs doesn't mean that there's no evidence at all for the other programs. There may be, they may be what's called evidence-informed. Is that correct? So that there, it's not to say that we're just sort of random.
Right.
There's just some different standards of evidentiary support for those programs. Is that correct?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. So an evidence-based program is one that meets very strict criteria on what type of research has been done. Usually there's a randomized control trial involved. They have to have shown repeated success on whatever measures they're looking at. So if they were looking at child health, they would have to show repeated measures. What we know about the evidence-informed is what we tend to call it is the majority of that is done by our counties who have had the TANF funding since 2003. The majority of them employ public health nurses, and public health nurses has a long 100-year tradition. They look at best practices, but they put their own program together. So if you went to, if you were served in a traditional home visiting in Kuching versus Dakota County versus Wantonwan, you could have a lot of variations and how long they see you and all of that. So yes, it's based on best practice. It just doesn't have the solid research behind it.
Okay, thank you. And seeing as how I asked a question, I feel like I should, I was going to wait till the end, but I think I'm going to call on members as long as folks have some clarification questions. And so Representative Pryor will call on you, and then Ms. Reckinger will complete after that. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just, to spend another minute on these sources of funding, and you said that in 2017, there was a boost in funding. And one question I have is, was that kind of like to a baseline where that was going to continue, or was that one time additional money that was given to grants?
Ms. Reckinger.
Thank you, Representative Pinto and Representative Pryor. That was, it initially started out at $6 million for the first 2 years. It was 17 and 18, and then, or 18, 19, sorry, and then 2021, it is $20 million and thereafter, and that's why I have the plus. So it's in MDH's base budget at this point.
Representative Pryor, any further from you? So maybe not. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Reckinger, I'm wondering about, you referenced that some of the folks who are doing those visits are nurses, but I got the sense that not all of them are. Can you speak a little bit to the ones who are not? What is the background or training or education of those folks?
Ms. Reckinger.
Thank you, Representative Pino and Representative Bolden. So Minnesota is pretty unique. We have about 400 public health nurses in our state, which is really, if you compare us to other states, kind of unheard of. Public health nurses doing home visiting, doing lots of other things too, WIC, emergency preparedness, you know, depending how small the county is, they could have multiple hats. And we were like that until the probably about 2018 when the new funding came out and nonprofits were able to apply. What we know about the nonprofits, and we're just getting to know them and doing kind of more research on or data collection on who are these home visitors and that. What we know about all of them is each evidence-based model requires a home visitor has their own recommendations of what it should be. Some models only require a paraprofessional, but then they go through anywhere from a week to 3 weeks of training to learn the model. And that would be how to approach a family about, you know, prenatal stuff, how to go over the curriculum, how do you talk to family, how do you be a helper and not a judgmental person. So each home visiting model has its own set of training, which ranges from a week to 3 weeks. Then they have follow-up support that they give those agencies and home visitors. We know that in the metro, probably that's where more of our nonprofits exist. And so I think previously we had seen probably a bachelor's degree was the sort of baseline. If it wasn't a nurse, it was a bachelor's. We now have people from all over who are doing this. And so, you know, it might be almost a grandma who's got, you know, lots of kids and lots of experience and knows her community well, and she goes through the training and then does this. So I don't have good statistics other than to say right now I would say about 85% of our work home visiting workforce is nurses. The rest are non-nurses. What that other 15% is made up of is we're still sort of getting a pulse on that. And it's a wide range. It could be someone who has a GED and someone who has a bachelor's degree in social work.
All right, thank you. Representative Bolden, follow up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Reckinger. My question is probably not directly under your purview, but you know, you obviously interact with new mothers and families, and I'm wondering if there's any data that's been collected about the impact of new mothers losing medical assistance that they got during their pregnancy and for the first 60 days postpartum. You know, in Minnesota, new mothers lose that coverage. And in the midst of a mental health crisis and with the knowledge that Black Minnesotans and American Indian Minnesotans have 3 to 4 times the maternal mortality rate as their white counterparts, I'm wondering if you have any data on how that might impact that.
Ms. Reckinger.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Pinto and Representative Morrison. I would want to talk to our evaluation people about what we have. What I can say is that the home visitors are constantly assessing for health insurance. And if a family doesn't have health insurance or any needs, then they're helping to get them signed up or get them connected. So it is an issue that home visitors are constantly dealing with in the same way they're dealing with housing and lots of, you know, food and basic necessities in addition to the actual parenting skills and that they want to do. I think we could take a look into our data and see what trends we have. Looking at the actual impact, I think would be trickier to do, but we just haven't had the capacity to do that yet. So I probably am not the best one to speak beyond that.
If you could look into that, Ms. Reckinger, that would be helpful and see what more you can find to let us know. I'm looking to see, it doesn't look like Representative Morrison has a follow-up. I think Representative Pryor, you had a follow-up from your earlier question. And I do want to move through real quickly if we can.
Yeah, I know. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know we could spend still a lot of time on this. So my question again for Ms. Reckinger is, before you were saying the families that are eligible in counties, it's, you know, maybe 20%. The most that we see in a county is 40%. And so when you look at the funding that's available, so from even all of these sources, we're still falling short of the families that we could be serving. And so that's, when I see that you say, you know, that it's going to be, we're increasing the funding. How are we going to get at that? How far is that going to go, basically, so that more of these families that would qualify are actually being served by the program?
Ms. Reckinger.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pryor. When we get all of the funding out, and it takes a while to get the funding out, to get agencies started, they have to hire people, get them trained, recruit families, and there's a learning period in the first year of, like, who to do. We figure it takes about 2 to 3 years to get a program stable. So if we look at that we just got a huge influx of money, and, you know, and then, of course, there's this little pandemic thing going on. But let's just say in 2022 or so, we're hitting more of a stability. I would think our percentages, if right now I estimate that we're hitting an average across the state is 12 to 14%, we might get to 16 to 18 with the current funding we have. Again, because it's a long-term service, and while we think it's a good investment and, you know, pretty a lot of return, it's still $6,500 per family per year. And so it's not 10. And and because you're keeping that family, so you have to wait till they graduate to get a new spot in. So I don't think everyone is so grateful for the investment that Minnesota has made. So I don't want to belittle this at all. I think other states are calling us to say, how did you get that public health nurses could bill? That's, you know, amazing to most states and this influx. But if the goal of the state is to reach, you know, 30, 50%, 100% of eligible children, we are far from that.
So Ms. Reckinger, I'll ask you if you can just go through your final couple slides very, very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is almost the last one. So this is just sort of a picture of different funding that goes to home visiting. And on the left-hand side, again, it's early Head Start and Head Start, so it's a little mucky. So there's the feds coming in with that amount of money. And again, it's both Head Start and early Head Start. And then on the right-hand side is the money that we oversee at the State Department. And I just put this slide up to get a sense. And then this is just the last slide, is that we know some repeated studies and analysis have shown that the models do, not that we've been able to do at the state, but that for every dollar invested, there's often a $3 to $6 return on investment for home visiting. And I believe that there's a video. You guys can all watch it on your own.
Well, the video is going to be one of the things I most wanted to do, but I think perhaps just to have folks really understand this, but I think we'll ask members to check that out. I'm going to ask if there are questions for you. I know I've got just one thing I wanted to address, but any other questions from members? I'm looking for hands up. And as I wait for that, I just want to ask Ms. Reckinger, maybe we can bring your presentation back down.
Okay.
I don't know that we need that up. Yeah, no problem. Your presentation focused a lot, and even at one point in the slide talked about targeted home visiting and really targeting on particular groups, and also talked about long-term approach. But as I've studied this, my understanding is that there are models that are even funded in Minnesota, or maybe eligibly funded, that are universal. Again, this would be entirely voluntary to families, of course, but where it's offered to, let's say, with every single child, maybe every single first child born in a hospital, somebody approaches and asks the family if they need any assistance in this form. And it could be short term rather than long term. Am I right about that? That there are universal and even essentially short term models where the family maybe gets one visit and then that's the end of it, as opposed to it always being targeted and long term? If you can just talk about that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. There, so of the 20 models that the feds have approved, there is one short-term model, and it's called Family Connects, and we do have that here in Minnesota. We started it, again, with this evidence-based funding that we got. Right now, Minneapolis is the grantee who is doing it, and what it involves is a nurse home visitor. They visit the family immediately after, and it's anywhere from 1 to 5 visits, and they often refer the family to a long-term model. But yes, it is a short-term model.
And Ms. Reckinger, and I believe that one is also can be a universal model as well.
Yes, right? Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. It actually is based on being a universal model. So what you pick is a geographic area, and it could be, I think Minneapolis has sort of picked an 18-block area and said every family in this 18-block area who delivers a child is, and they work largely out of Abbott. We are going to try and connect with every family. So it's not all of Minneapolis. It's a very specific, but it is designed. A few other states, North Carolina, Illinois, Texas, are looking at this model. How could they bring it statewide?
Thank you. Good. I just wanted folks not to have the wrong impression. There's always targeted long-term, that there are some other approaches too. Good. I'm just looking for any other questions from folks and not seeing any. So I want to thank you so much, Ms. Reckinger, and especially for coming back. Really appreciate it. And members will be hearing about home visiting, I know, again, with our committee. So thank you so much. And then turning then to Mr. Dave Ellis, who is a Minnesota ties, though joining us from New Jersey. This is one of the advantages of having our virtual sessions, that we can have folks from other places. And so Mr. Ellis, if you can please identify yourself and then please proceed with your presentation. I'm so glad to have you with us today.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is an interesting thing to be sitting in my house in Somerset, New Jersey. My wife and I are long-term Minnesota residents. And Mr. Chair, do I have the ability to share my screen?
I believe that you do. I may look to our committee administrator or our legislative assistant confirm, but I think if you try the share screen function, I'm thinking, and I believe the answer is yes, is what I'm hearing. So give it a try.
Well, we're going to see how this works.
Yep.
As you know, Mr. Chair, I am not the greatest technician in the world.
Okay. You're looking good though.
I will do my best to make sure that this works out.
We're able to see your presentation looking good, Mr. Ellis.
Thank you, sir. So my name is Dave Ellis, and I am a very long-term resident of the city of Minneapolis. My wife and I lived there for over 40 years in North Minneapolis. I am a father of 5 adult children. I have 19 grandchildren and 1 great-grandchild. All of them came through Minneapolis Public Schools. And they're all doing as well as I can say any 5 adult children can do in this world. I'm a former state employee. I left the Minnesota Department of Corrections in 2007 after about 25 years. My wife and I are former foster parents up until the time that we moved to the state of New Jersey. We were kinship foster parents for 2 of our grandchildren. There are lots of other things I could say about me, but those will all come out eventually. And if not, I'm sure someone will be able to fill that in. And why me? I think part of it is I occupy a unique office here in New Jersey. It's the first of its kind. I am the executive director of the Office of Resilience. It's a specific position created in partnership with 3 foundations and the Department of Children and Families. My office is housed at the Department of Children and Families. I am part of the commissioner's executive team, and my responsibility is a liaison between state agencies, community, foundations, and nonprofits. Most of my world right now is around the release of a statewide action plan that was created to address adverse childhood experiences. For the last, 10, 12, 15 years, I used to work with an organization called Minnesota Communities Caring for Children, the old Prevent Child Abuse Minnesota, doing trauma trainings across the state of Minnesota. My history, I've trained probably 15,000 people from Minnesota, specifically on adverse childhood experiences, and I'm one of 2 of the original certified master trainers on the curricula around that area. And I've had a number of opportunities to work with Representative Pinto, specifically as a member of the Elders for Infants group. I am one of the members of that organization also. And I guess since this is an education committee, I would be remiss if I didn't say that I was on the founding board of the Center for Excellence in Urban Teaching at Hamline University, in addition to being a 2013 Bush Fellow. So I have deep ties to Minnesota. I call it home now, and it will be home until I live somewhere else longer and establish deeper ties. But the other reason, I guess, that I talk about this, and I know this is hard to see. When I first started doing this work, we had a conference up at the Earl Brown Center, a specific conference for African-American and Native Americans that were being impacted by adverse childhood experiences. Folks told us we weren't going to have many people come. We had about 300 people show up at this little conference. This is just one. We did a lot of graphic harvesting. Graphic report outs from sessions. This is just one of the many pieces, and it's one that I keep around me because what I see are children being held. Now, there's a fallacy when I look at this, because children do not exist outside of the context of family. So if you're going to serve children, by default, you have to serve families. You can't make children better unless you make families better. And this work for me around adverse childhood experiences is all about that. As I said, I've done a lot of different trainings, and I know Representative Pinto, first I want to thank you for the invitation to be here today, and I want to thank all of you for being here and the members of the public that are out there. I don't take this lightly. I believe that this message is the one that right now, in this time, is exceptionally important. We talk about COVID as being the pandemic. Recognize we're in multiple pandemics right now. From what I can tell, there's the COVID, of course. There's also things around racial justice that are creating its own pandemic. And that's a pandemic that's been happening here since the founding of this country. And we haven't really recognized it until just recently. There's also this thing around climate. And I know not everybody believes that there's issues around climate. I get that. And I'm a full believer that everyone is entitled to their belief because it's their experience. But from what I read and what I see, I believe that there is a pandemic. And the other pandemic is ACEs, whether we want to recognize it or not. The difference is, this is one, we teach these things. These are not things that our kids are born with. And so if we stop and think about it, this is a slide I often use when I'm doing training, when I'm talking about ACEs. And so if you've seen this slide before, you begin to know and recognize that when children are born, they don't have many synaptic connections. As I refer to it with people when I'm training, they do four basic things: eat, sleep, poop, cry. And if you look at that, there's four basic clusters there. But what happens when that child is in utero, the first thing that happens is that we hook them up to a fire hose of information. And from that day on, everything we say and do influences how that child will develop. Not just us, but every place that we get information from. In fact, when you see the synaptic density around elementary age, at age six, you see the difference. And what we tell people is, you have to understand that what gets experienced is what gets hardwired into the brain. You notice I didn't say whether it was good or bad. I just said what gets experienced. And what gets experienced the most is where you see those really dark lines. It's at that point in our lives that we'll have the most synaptic connections that we'll ever have. And so, as my mother used to tell me, if you don't use it, you'll lose it. That's what happens. The things that we don't use very much get pruned out. And by puberty, we're pretty much on a roll. We know everything is pretty much wired in. And at that point, it becomes exceptionally difficult to change. Not that we can't do that, but it's much easier if we prevent it than to try to repair the harm that's been done. The problem with prevention, as I've come to understand, is that prevention is a story that's written in data that has invisible victims and invisible heroes. You can't prove that something you didn't do changed things. It's just hard. You can't prove it. If you read the book Upstream by Dan Heath, he will tell you all about it. I become so fascinated with this idea that we need to move upstream, that it's where I spend all of my time now, trying to figure out how far upstream do we need to go to truly have an impact. Basic message, we are creatures of adaptation. That from conception, we have childhood experiences. We adapt to those experiences, and then they show up in our adult life. Doesn't matter whether you grow up in that world on the top loop that we refer to as a malevolent world. And by the way, the slides that you're looking at have all been reviewed and approved by Dr. Martin Teicher at Harvard Medical. So if you have questions about any of them, I can give you the citations around any of these slides that you see, with the exception of my two beginning slides. Okay, those came from my own space. We know that the problem really occurs when biology collides with our social expectations. When we send kids to school, we expect them to come and show up, be ready to work, be quiet, sit down, do all types of things. Children who have been impacted by adverse childhood experiences may not be able to do that. And it's not that they have a choice. It's that that's how they're hardwired. I know because I'm one of those kids. I'm the kid, I was the teacher's worst nightmare because I couldn't sit. I couldn't be quiet. And the thing is, typically when I do a training, the first question that I ask people in the conversation is to talk to each other about what makes you feel safe. And most of us don't consider that because we feel pretty safe. But when you actually start to dig down into what makes you feel safe, most people will come up with my family, my faith, being financially secure. Well, you know what folks like me feel safe with? Chaos. I need chaos in order to be safe, feel safe. I need the unpredictable. Problem is that usually collides with social expectations. But I have a right to be feel safe just like everyone else does. And the question is, how do we allow for both? How do we create space where everyone can have those things? You know, there's the ACE study. I had my first introduction to ACEs in San Diego. Vince Valetti, one of the co-principal investigators, and I had a really long conversation after his presentation because it was the first day I didn't feel like I was crazy. And for those of us who experience a high level of trauma, that happens often because the things that you see other people would tell you don't exist. This is the question. This is the whole premise of what the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study is built on. This thing that says that from conception or preconception to death, so it's a life course model, that we go through a number of things that for many of us, and in this country, I would pretty much say all of us, that there is some implication around historic and intergenerational trauma. Typically, when people talk about this, they want to talk about African-American, Native American. And yes, the data within the study points to those two groups as being the most directly impacted. The thing is, that wasn't in the original conversation. We're just now recognizing the implications of what epigenetics is truly telling us about our history and the implications of that. And so what we're doing is we're building on top of a flawed foundation that has never been addressed. And it makes it really difficult as you begin to move up. When this thing was created, this pyramid, the top three pieces, early death, disability, disease, social problems, health risk, 95 cents of every dollar, that's where it went. Even though our research, I mean, Art Rolnick talks often about a 16-to-1 return on investment the deeper we dive into this pyramid. That in fact, it's, you know, and I hear the term early childhood often, and then maybe this is a bias for me, but typically when I hear it, people are talking 0 to 6, but all of the money seems to flow to 4, 5, and 6. When all of the research tells us that the greatest return on investment is 0 to 3. And my question to everyone is, why is that? Why are we not focused on our earliest? I realize that it's easy to catch them when they're at school, but by then we've allowed them to learn and develop those behaviors and in fact practice them for a number of years before we do anything to truly try to step in and change it. And I'm not saying that we have to abandon all of the things that we're doing. I'm saying that we need to really stop and think about how we do fund. You know, I listened to the last presentation. And, you know, I applaud all of the things that she talked about. One of the things that I have come to recognize in my world and understand I live for community. The work I'm doing in New Jersey, the first thing that I told them was that I would not come unless you share power with the community. And by community, I mean those directly impacted, not the nonprofits who get paid by the state or a foundation because they are part of the system and a community recognizes them as such. which is why you have some of the difficulties that you have. And by you, I mean me too, because I run into the same problem. The conversations I'm having in New Jersey is, first conversation is, we do a lot of fiscal impact statements for legislation. Has anybody ever done a trauma impact statement? Do you look and see what the impact trauma-wise is going to be on people before we do those things? So what is the road to hell is paved with good intentions? Let's stop and take a look. Let's ask those people who are directly impacted. This is what we're considering. A, is this something you want? And B, will it help? And maybe before we even do that, we go and ask them, what do you think will work? And put them in decision-making positions and give them the power and the information to be involved in their own lives. Give them the same information you're getting today. I can pretty much guarantee you that most of the folks out there that are being impacted don't get this information. And so it's really difficult to be a participant in helping to lead your own life. The original study talked about 10 specific ACEs, right? We've come to find out that there's many more. We know that bullying, homelessness, food insecurity, all these things, that they're all tied into this and more. This study's been replicated over 1,500 times around the world in different racial, ethnic groups, different socioeconomic situations. And it's funny because the numbers pretty much turn out to be the same. They don't change much. The other thing that we know, if you studied any of the work by Dr. Wendy Ellis around the pair of ACEs, you'll find that that conversation talks about all of the implications in community. The things that you grow up in a neighborhood where you hear gunshots and sirens all the time. What does that truly do to people?
Hey, Dave, can I just, if you can go back one, back to that slide, the prior one, I just, for folks who, because there may be folks who may not, I know the next one, there may be folks who are not familiar, and can you just sort of confirm that this is what we're talking about, is the study from, boy, probably 20 years ago now, I'm thinking, that found that the adults who had these issues when they were children have health issues as adults that you wouldn't even think would be connected, and yet they apparently are. Can you just sort of, for somebody who may not have heard of the study in the first place, just give a one sentence description of that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. I will tell you, I am rushing with this presentation. If I were, I would be going much slower, recognizing that this presentation is typically a 3-hour conversation. It's 2 hours of presentation, because what we've learned is that training by itself doesn't work. You need to offer people an opportunity for a change moment. And so we have small group dialogues on the back end and start to ask people, have you done your own work yet? Right? And so there's a lot of exploration that has to happen with reflection. But this specific study was done in the early 1990s. Let's just put it that way. It involved over 17,000 people. It is a study that was a partnership between the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Kaiser Permanente Health Plan. Those 17,000 people were mostly white. They were middle class. They all had health insurance. And when I say mostly white, there was a 6% African-American population in that group. So there were others represented, but it was majority white. I always get the question, does this pertain to people of color? And my statement to folks is, the last time I looked at it, my brain developed like everybody else's based on the experiences that I had. And it has nothing to do with my color. It has to do with the experiences that I had to have as a child. But what we know is through the research, first of all, is that this is a self-report. And 87% of the time where you find one of these, you find more than one. So they rarely occur in a singularity. And the more of them that you have, the more likely you are to have all different types of health issues. And that was one of the things on that next slide. This is one of the list of just a few of the things that show up later in life, right? We also know that children, school-aged children, if they experience four or more of these, that they're 83% more likely to end up in juvenile corrections. I mean, there are implications. And the thing is, this is all information that's available to us. And then my question on the back end is, if we know this, why are we not acting? Why are we allowing the fodder to be created to keep the system turning? Now, I'm a huge fan of education. I have discovered a couple of things about education, though. And one of them just became crystal clear to me in a meeting yesterday. In New Jersey, we're on this mission to do two things, or a number of things, but two of them are. One is to eliminate the need for out-of-home placement. Now, I lived in Hennepin County. I know what the out-of-home placement budget was for Hennepin County. I mean, it did nothing but grow for a very long time. Yes, I still read the Star Trib, so I know that those numbers are starting to fall. So don't get me wrong, I am still connected to Minnesota, but I do know the numbers that go along with that. Last year, New Jersey averaged 5,400 cases across the state of kids in out-of-home placement. Now, I don't know what Hennepin County's numbers is, but I think it's probably larger than that. But the question is, how do you begin to go about doing that? Well, part of that is to begin to recognize and start to act on the things that you truly know are things that are having a negative impact on the citizenry that we all are here to serve. Because that's what my role is. I am not a state employee in New Jersey, by the way. I am a consultant. Fascinating, right? Create a position within state government that reports to the commissioner that has my responsibility doesn't just go through Department of Children and Families. I have 9 other state agencies that I am coordinating all of the trauma work in. And all of there are assistant commissioners that attend the meetings so that we can make sure we have decision makers. You can't do this if all we do is sit and talk about it. At some point, we all have to make the decisions. Now, this study, when it first got released, there are lots of folks who didn't believe this. Their statement was, this can't possibly be true in middle-class white families. This has nothing to do with socioeconomics. You know, we had a conversation once about poverty, and it was poverty, an adverse childhood experience. What we've come to find out is that it's not. There are lots of poor folks. I grew up poor. Lots of poor folks grow up and do exceptionally well. But we do know that if these other things that you see on there exist, it will exacerbate those. And for those of you in the audience, just take a look at those 10. And I'm not asking you to do anything other than consider, before your 18th birthday, do you remember any of those things happening in your family? That's the question. It's a question I ask constantly of people in all professions. And when I talk about education, I don't know about Minnesota, but here in New Jersey, and I think it's, if I remember correctly, it's the same way. When folks come out, they're very young and they have little life experience. And they really don't understand this piece. Especially if they haven't been around communities that have been impacted by adverse childhood experiences. And so when they come out, there's a naivete that goes along with that. One of the things that we're looking at in New Jersey is requiring that anyone coming out in a helping profession have a base understanding of trauma and what trauma does to the lives of people. We require all kinds of other things. Why not require something along that line? So that when people come out, they have an understanding that there's nothing wrong with people out here. But the real thing is about what happened to them along the way. And how do we figure out how to address that? If you don't take anything else away from what I'm telling you today, understand that these things are very common. But where you find one, you find more than one. And that they impact things across the life course. To give you an example, of how simple something like this flows. And we'll talk about generational. As you're sitting there, I want you to cross your arms. Just sit back and cross your arms. You know, that's one of the things that we do all the time. I constantly sit like this. And people always think I'm closed when I do that, but it's comfortable for me. I'm a big guy, and so crossing my arms helps out. Now, what I want you to do is to uncross your arms. Cross them the other way. How easy is that? It's not easy at all. And it's a simple move. But what it talks about how the brain gets wired, you don't have a choice. You get so uncomfortable trying to do things differently that you normally default back to what you do. And that's what we're talking about here. That's how powerful things like this are. And trying to understand how this all works. I'm coming to the end of this presentation. I will tell you that. And so if folks have questions, tee them up here in a moment. I will be quiet, I promise you. In case you haven't figured out yet, I am a storyteller. I am not a story writer. I could never be as eloquent in writing as the 22-year-old African-American woman who was the youth poet laureate. I'm not that person. But I do like to storytell, so forgive me for that part. What you see is this piece around population attributable risk, and those, if there's folks in there from public health, you can explain this better than I can. The woman who was doing the presentation before, I'm sure she understands this better than I'll ever understand it, right? But I happen to have a script that was written by MDs that I can work from to help me explain these things. So the pie pieces that you see, basically what it's telling us is that if you take a look at alcoholism, the research tells us right now that we believe that 65% of issues around alcoholism are caused by adverse childhood experiences. And so if you can imagine this just being a piece of paper and you poke a hole in the middle of the paper and you see the oil start to seep through that hole, right? And it spreads out. That's what you're seeing here. If you use your imagination, the pie pieces are never exactly that shape, right? Because we know that that things are not equal. That when you look at workplace injuries versus cancer, then the pieces look different. But just take a look at this. 65% of alcoholism is attached to ACEs. And you know, we always talk about this idea that we want people to not work in silos, but I'm a proponent of silos. If, number one, we share information with everybody else, because we tend to get into our silos and we don't talk to one another, right? And oftentimes we'll put up rules that say we can't talk to anybody else. And that lack of being able to share information is a roadblock in helping people. The other piece of this is that if you understand ACEs and you work in your silo, when you impact one, you impact them all. So if you're working around chemical dependency and alcoholism, do your work there. Do it really well, because you're going to impact. And this is only one of these. This presentation, I did not pull out one. And we have multiples of these slides. And so had I dug deeper into my file, I probably would have found Minnesota specific data, because I do have you have access to this, student survey, Minnesota student survey has ACEs-like questions in it. I don't know if the Department of Health is still doing, I know they're doing the BRFAS, but I don't know if they've got the ACE questionnaire in it. We did this, I want to say 2011, that this was done, and I was part of helping to create the study and to do the analysis. So I should remember the year, but I don't. I'm sorry, Representative Pinto, you had a question.
Well, no, I actually another member did, but I think what I'm going to have you do is I kind of want to alert that other member that I'm inclined to have you finish, and then we'll get to that question and the other ones as well. and do things that way.
Absolutely. But you can go out to the Department of Health website. You'll be able to find information there. I am advocating in New Jersey that we do it every 3 years so that we have a benchmark. It's hard to tell if you're being successful if you can't take a look and have some measuring stick, right? And so that's what I'm advocating. We truly do have the power. It does require us to work together. And in today's climate, it's going to take a lot of work for us to figure out how to work together. But if we can put aside those things that we disagree vehemently on and focus on the things that we can truly work on and make a difference in. You know, I learned a long time ago that diversity is not about difference or sameness. Diversity is about conflict. You cannot mix oil and water together, shake it up, and expect it to stay suspended. It doesn't work. It always separates out into its two constituent parts. That's what we keep trying to figure out how to do, is to have us all kind of fit together. And I have too many edges to fit together. I can tell you that right now. I'm the person, I told you, I'm not politically correct. If you look at the forms that the state of Minnesota has, there's a 16A form. They created that form for me. It's the form when you're doing contracting and you don't follow the rules. They tell you have to sign off on that form, read the policies and procedures around it, and promise not to do it again. One of the things I've found out is that there's a slowness that means death out in the community if we can't do things in a little bit more expedient way. And so I had the 16A form on my desktop. I had my electronic signature on it, and all I had to do was date it and print it. Yes, it was a way around the process, but it also got us what we needed to do the work. And I'm not advocating that everyone do that. That was me and my 20 plus years history in the Department of Corrections. Sure, you guys must have heard from Ann Mastin at some point in time at the University of Minnesota. Ann talks about the core protective systems, that all of these things you see on the left, capabilities, attachment, belonging, and community culture and spirituality, that all three of them by themselves are very impactful. But if you nest them, if you can put all three of them together around families, the research tells us that the increase in their ability to do their work is off the charts. I did not bring it with me. I do have it, but I don't have time for it. The research in Washington State around what truly helps, right? And so there's a whole piece around hope and healing in that piece. But when we think about this and we think about the attachment and belonging phase of this, this is that space where everybody wants to go, where we always talk about we want to have relationships, caring relationships with adults. And we want, you know, it takes a village. First of all, it takes a healthy village, not just a village. The second thing is that we always forget the second C in that conversation. It's not just about caring people. It's about being caring and competent. And so how do we make sure that as we're doing these things and we're building relationships, if you haven't read Dr. Daniel Siegel's book, The Whole Brain Child, I would fully recommend it. He is one of the leading authorities on attachment and belonging, the piece around community, faith, and cultural practices. Look at what the Native American community is doing. This is the model when I talk to people about how you build community capacity. It's a public health model. And those are the four steps that communities that are doing this work that are succeeding, those are the four things that all of them have in common. You may not recognize the word. The word is sawubona, and it's my last slide. Sawubona is a Swahili word, and it means I see you. But it's not the ICU as I'm looking at you on these little Zoom screens, right? This is a deeper invitation. It's an invitation to truly dig into the compassion and humanity that we have and to figure out how do we truly do our work differently so that we engage those who are most impacted and rarely in the conversations at all, and not have someone carry their message, have them carry their own message and have them be the decision maker, right? Hear the stories that truly make us who we are. And in all of this work, regardless of what it is all about relationships. The one thing I learned after shooting in Florida many years ago, we had a conversation about what did we learn from the George Zimmerman trial or verdict. And I remember we hosted two dialogues, one at Wilder down on Lexington. And we got calls saying folks from the Second Amendment rights folks were coming. They were going to disrupt the meeting. And we said, please let them come. Don't do anything out of the ordinary. Please let them come. They did not show up. There was a heavier St. Paul police presence after that, but they did not show up. We did the second one in Rochester. We had about 100 people show up. And again, we were told that the Tea Party and Second Amendment folks were going to show up. And again, the statement was, please let them come. And they did. And you know, it was interesting because we had probably 15, 20 tables of people in there because we like to keep the group small and intimate. And as they came in, one man came up to me and he says, you know, we hear that you're going to talk about Second Amendment rights and those types of things based on the killing in Florida. And we said, well, we're going to talk about what did we learn. I said, and he said, can we join us? Absolutely. I said, the only thing that we ask is that you don't all sit at one table. Spread yourselves out. There's a whole group of people in here that want to hear your story, that want to share their story, and let's see where we end up at the end of the night. And I remember he came up to me at the end of the night and he says, you know, we found out a number of things. He said, the first thing we found out is that even though we thought we were so much different, we all want the same things. We want an education system that works. We want a school. We want a government that works. We don't want it to be overly large. I mean, all of the things he rattled off. And he said, you know, the other thing that happened, he says, we actually got to know some folks here. So we didn't know who they were. We actually are neighbors. And we've been having trouble with the kids in the neighborhood. And he said, you know what? They're going home with us to stop it right now. And I looked at him, I said, oh, so you mean the parents are going? And he said, yeah. He said, they're not the parents. They know who the parents are. So they're going with us to the parents' house and we're going to talk to the kids and we're going to solve this right now. And I said, okay. You know, it was like, we can do this work. It's not rocket science. It is consent-based and readiness-driven. It's heart work. It's hard, but it's heart work. You're talking about changing hearts when you're doing this. And so as you think about the work that you do, please, please consider those things. I'm not a researcher. I understand the importance of it. And you know, I keep hearing people refer to evidence-based best practices and everything else. Take a look at your evidence-based programs and look at how many of those small mom and pop shops that were culturally specific are no longer in existence. The very fact should tell you that something is amiss. And what I've come to learn in doing all of this work is that this idea of being evidence-based, yes, it's important. And there are also things that are practice-based. The things that the community know works because they are out there and it works every day. For us, that's just as valid as the research on paper that everyone wants to put in front of me. In fact, it's more valid because typically they're culturally attached also. And so as you go about doing your work, I'm a proponent, a big proponent of home visiting. If I could figure out how to give money away, if I had it, I give half of my money to home visiting, half of my money to Early Head Start. They're the two pieces that I know that work. They're already in people's homes, so we don't have to redesign anything. and they do the work already. We just don't fund them at the levels that they need to be. And you notice I said early Head Start. I did not say Head Start. If you look at your Head Start funding, probably the majority of those to Head Start and another smaller piece goes to early Head Start. You need to flip that. And I know that's a crazy thing. It will make all of those folks, the lobbyists for Head Start, will go nuts if you start talking about that. So just, you can blame it on me if you need to. I got big shoulders, I can handle it. Thank you, sir, for allowing me to present. Let me see how I can.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ellis. And as you're doing that, yeah, bring it on back. Thank you. Yes, I think the proponents for various programs will be clipping different portions of your remarks for their purposes later. That was really powerful. Thank you so much. So we've got several member questions. We've got a total of about 15 minutes, including the answers. So I'm going to ask, Mr. Ellis, you often give these long answers, which are amazing. And so just a reminder that we're trying to fit all that in. I'm going to call on Representative Wasilowicz first. And I know a lot of folks will have a lot to ask you about your amazing presentation. So Representative Wasilowicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Ellis, for your presentation today. The question that I had was, you had sort of talked about the ACEs early on, the 10 ACEs, and then talked about how we know there are others as well. And I was just wondering, I found that slide that had the percentages of like alcoholism and other things that were tied to the ACEs. And I'm wondering if you could just clarify if that data was those 10 ACEs from the original study or if that included other ones that we know.
That is from the
original. Mr. Ellis.
I didn't mean to cut you off. And thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. That is from the original study. All of those numbers are from the original studies. The 1,500 replications of that study, there's a specific one in Philadelphia that's urban driven. So if you want to see information about people of color specifically, that one has a lot of information in it. But yes, that the numbers I put up are from the original study. And Representative Pinto, unfortunately, I have a medical appointment at what will be 11:15 here, and I do need 15 minutes to get there. Okay. So it's close to what would be, I guess, 10 o'clock there.
We have to be done at 10 a.m. our time. We should be over that. Good. It looks like Representative Wasilowicz does not have a follow-up. So Chair Dabney will call on you.
Thank you, Mr. Ellis, thank you for this presentation, very informative. There's increasing conversation about the pandemic as in ACEs, that kind of all kids, whatever ACE score they had before, they're plus one now. And I'm just wondering if you can help us think about how the pandemic fits into the ACEs model.
Mr. Ellis.
Thank you, Representative Pinto and Representative Dabney. I think you might be able to add more than one to whatever that is. The COVID by itself has destroyed everything. I mean, you're talking about relationships that aren't there. You're the camaraderie that happens at school. And I don't know what's happening in Minnesota, but what we're not seeing more reports of child abuse or domestic violence, but the calls are increasing. And that's worrying to me because these things can exacerbate and get out of hand quickly. I will also say, for me as a person of color, COVID is only one more thing. I know everybody wants to talk about COVID, and I get that. But I can die and be impacted by things much more serious than COVID for me. That folks are forgetting. So yes, COVID is there, but don't forget the other things that are impacting folks.
Thank you, Mr. Ellis. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. You know, you're making me think, Mr. Ellis, has racism itself been identified as an ACE or as the equivalent? I mean, I would think that the answer would be yes, but can you just shed light on that?
Short answer, yes. Yes. When you start talking about historic and generational trauma, you're talking about all of those pieces. And so, yes, we know that that's In fact, we believe that those of us that do this work, we believe that it is one of the root causes of all of this. When you start talking about ACEs, that piece cuts across every ACE that we have because it's built into how everything operates. Our country was founded on those principles and we still operate under them. So there's no way to truly get totally away from them. And I know that's hard for some folks to hear. And yet, if we can't talk about it, if we can't figure out a way to civilly talk about it, we'll never get there. We'll always be stuck. And quite frankly, I'm done being stuck because when things are stuck, people are dying.
Right. Are there, during your presentation, I was thinking about a comment that's made by one of your Elders for Infants colleagues, one of your fellow Elders for Infants, Jane Kretzmann. And she says that babies' bodies have memories. You know, we don't remember the most important year of each of our lives, which was the first 12 months, but that that our bodies remember. Can you talk about that? Does that resonate with you?
Absolutely, Representative Pinto. What we know about human development is that the brain develops from back to front, from its most primitive to its most complex. And so when we do this training, we often talk about, here's how you can talk to children. You can also help adults have it because we all have a handy dandy brain. So if you have your hand and you think about folding your thumb in, this is the space that develops first, the limbic system, the amygdala, hippocampus, and all those pieces. This is also the seat of memory. This is where that first 3 years gets stored. We don't forget it. The body remembers. And so it stores it here. And if you fold your hand over, what we talk about here is the cortex, and this is the prefrontal cortex where executive function lives. So when we become triggered, we flip our lid. And so all of this goes offline. The cortex and the prefrontal cortex, you cannot access it, which is why we tell people children do not have an option here, and adults either. Once you do this, this takes over. This is fight, flight, freeze territory. And that's the only thing that you can do until you can figure out how to self-regulate. And so the key here is to teach people and help people understand how to self-regulate. But that's that whole piece about body memory.
Thank you. And for members of the public, we have, I hope folks are aware, a select committee on racial justice that met this fall. And ACEs was one of the topics that was discussed, of course. And I want to call on Representative Damuth, who's the vice chair of that committee. I believe that was your title. And maybe you have some comments or questions as well. Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak. And thank you, Director Ellis, for what you've shared this morning. Incredibly important. I first was made aware of ACEs when I served my local school board a number of years ago, and hearing how ACEs can affect our students and as educators, what we were looking to do to make changes. I can tell you that the work that the Select Committee on Racial Justice did this fall was very informative. We only held 5 meetings, definitely not enough. But what we identified, just kind of the core founding principles, were the effects of systemic racism, both that it exists, it's harmful, and we have to address it. Now, I know that there were a number of recommendations that came out of that. As vice chair, I was not a part of developing those recommendations, nor was I included, but still very happy to serve on the committee. I think what we need to look at is instead of a number of overwhelming recommendations. One of the things that I think we as legislators can do is we can look at the effects of systemic racism and then also use that as founding principles in all of the work that we do, knowing that it exists, knowing we need to make changes. And to you, Director Ellis, I appreciate what you said about those earliest learners. How are we best spending our dollars that are available to empower families? And that can be in so many different ways. It can be in early learning scholarships. It can be in meeting our families as best as possible, the home visiting, so many different opportunities that we have that we need to take a look at is how are we best spending those dollars. So again, Mr. Chair, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak, and thank you to the both of the presenters today.
Thank you, Representative Damuth. Thank you for that. You're prompting a question for me, Mr. Ellis. So much of what we focus on is programs that are directly aimed at the child or at perhaps caregiving for the child, et cetera. Representative Damon had referenced some of those. But what I picked up a lot from what you talked about is just the importance of supporting the family, that there may be pieces where, and just that relationship with the adult is key. Can you talk about kind of, you know, focusing energy on thinking about the child narrowly versus versus providing support for the family more more broadly?
First of all, Representative Damon, thank you for those words. And I am in absolute agreement with what you said. I cannot be more appreciative of your voicing that. Representative Pinto, the whole piece around child and family is an interesting one, because we've had this whole conversation about the day of the child, the year of the child, in the best interest of the child. Problem is, the child doesn't live in a little bubble by itself. It lives in the family. And all of those interventions that we do out here with the child gets impacted by what's happening in the family. And so we can do all of the changing we want out here, but when we reinsert that child, and this is one of the reasons we're trying to end out-of-home placement, because we see that as one of the real barriers, is that we want those children to stay in a family unit, in their family unit. Now, is everything perfect within families? No, it's not. We all know that. But if we approach this through a punishment, shame, and blame frame, that has implications too. It makes the family, A, disengage. It also, whether we believe it or not, causes even more harm to that child. Because every time we bring them out of the family or move them, it has an impact. So as we think about what we're doing with children, in the book Upstream that I referred to earlier, one of the things that he talks about is, if you want to stop a burglar, the way that you do that, because we know that there are things that happen to the mother when the child's in utero, things that happen to the child as they're growing up because of circumstance, that that's where decisions get made and moves people into that space where they could become a burglar. If you want to impact that, you have to go back to at least maternal care, and probably further than that, so that you can impact the socioeconomic stance that that mother is in. And I say mother specifically because mother's carrying the baby. Fathers are in that conversation too. Do not, and that's one of the things we always do. We talk about mothers. If we're talking about families, you got to talk about fathers, whether they are together or not. The thing I learned in working in juvenile corrections for about 15 years is that every one of those kids wanted to know who their father was. And they wanted a relationship, whether or not they were there. So, but if you want to have that impact, you've got to change the socioeconomic structure back so that that mother does not experience those that adversity. And that's when I talk about, we have to get into the preconception business, because from the time the egg, two eggs join, all of that DNA, that child has every bit of that DNA. And so if we can lessen the amount of trauma in a person's life, theoretically, and again, this is about preventing, right? So how, when I talked about that whole story of prevention, how do you prove that? So that folks like you who make the determination that we're going to put money into something, significant money, how do we prove that to you? Even though we watch and we see it, again, it's back to that practice-based evidence thing. We know this to be true. What we don't have is all of the evidence, because it's invisible. And that's a hard story to sell.
Mr. Ellis, thank you so very much. I don't see other questions right now, and we need to wrap up, but this has been so helpful and so powerful. Thank you so very much. Really appreciate it. And we will continue to claim you, and always claim you as a Minnesotan, whether you're in New Jersey or anyplace else. So so grateful to you. Thank you so much.
Representative Pinto, again, thank you for that invitation. Thank you to all of you all of the folks on your committee, all of the people from the community. And I was hoping that Jane's name might pop up. I had told her, I said that invisible name that you see in Representative Pinto's description of Thursday, I said, that's me. And she went, uh-oh, I better let some folks know. I loved my years in Minnesota. I miss my house dearly. And I miss my kids and grandkids. But I hope to be back there in May. I'm hoping that they'll allow us to go somewhere. I've been on lockdown for over a year. Had I known that I wouldn't be able to go out and do what I do, I normally want to be out. I don't want to be in an office. Had I known that I could do my job this way, I would never have sold my house in Minneapolis. I would still be in Minneapolis. So COVID has changed how we do everything. And that, when you make your decisions, keep that in mind also. It's changed everything. Ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate you and I thank you for the opportunity. And please, if you ever want to hear from me again, Representative Pinto does know where to find me. And you have a great day.
Indeed, I do. Thank you so much. Thank you very much. So members, just a preview for next week. This is a really nice transition to what's coming up. We on Tuesday, we'll be hearing from the Prenatal to Three Policy Impact Center, which is a center at the University of Texas at Austin. So again, hearing from folks from around the country who've examined policies in this area and will report to us on where Minnesota fares compared to other states and really have done an exhaustive survey of our policies and others as well. And then on Thursday, we'll be hearing from an economist at the University of Minnesota. And so continuing to examine the impact that we can have. I think I'm going to hold off on a couple of the other small housekeeping points till next week. And with that, members, thank you so very much. And with that, we are adjourned.